Okay, so our speaker today is going to be Bianca Dietrich, who's going to speak about 3D holography from discretum to continuum.
Thanks, Jorge, and hello to everyone. So I'm speaking on some work which started with Wanantang Bonzon, and this follow-up works with Wanantang, Sebastian Misera, and Aldo Diello. And to give you an overview of the talk on slice 2, I start with a question which is more kind of philosophical. Is whether quantum gravity is fundamentally holographic? Then we change subject a bit, and actually I'm going to review a continuum calculation which was recently done. And we are going to redo this calculation basically in Ratchet calculus, but also extend it considerably. Basically to compute the 3D partition function in Ratchet calculus, and we basically look first at the one loop correction and then at the boundary fluctuations. So to go to slide 3, I pose the question whether quantum gravity is fundamentally holographic, and this already shows up in the generalized boundary formulation formulated by Robert Oeckel, and we have usually made heavily used it so far. And the main idea is to encode the dynamics of our series into amplitudes associated to space-time regions. And these space-time regions can be generalized, like have just be spheres and have a spherical boundary. So we have a boundary Hilbert space, and we associate an amplitude which is a functional on these boundary wave functions. And basically these are the solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equations, or the no boundary, give us no boundary wave functions. This looks holographic. However, in the standard formulation, one has actually the gluing axiom, which actually is quite essential because it tells you how to get amplitudes for more complicated regions, or you could say bigger regions, by gluing amplitudes for smaller regions. In this sense, it's actually a locality axiom, because you could say I can take very small regions and glue them all together, and you assume locality because you just have amplitudes associated to this region and to these small regions, and you get the more complicated ones by gluing these things together. If we go to slide 4, we however have that small regions doesn't make really sense in quantum gravity. And instead, what we should speak about is more complicated or less complicated boundary data. So what we really want to say is that the amplitude for more complicated boundary state can be glued from amplitudes for less complicated boundary states. And a general question is whether this actually holds in the continuum in all situations. But the problem is actually that, in fact, it does not hold in general in the discrete. And the reason is, if you do this gluing, what you assume is actually that you can put on this boundary a decomposition of unity. And if you put discrete data, usually you will miss most of this decomposition of unity, a big part. And it's very hard, and it's only in extremely special cases, that one manages to kind of coordinate the discreteness of the boundary data on the outer boundary with the discreteness of the boundary data on the inner boundary. So basically, the gluing axiom or the locality axiom does not hold in the discrete if we really go to these formulations and want to reproduce continuum physics. And it shows up if you want to really reproduce continuum physics, you either have to deal with non-local amplitudes or do something else. And this something else is what I call the consistent boundary formulation, where one does not assume the gluing axiom as fundamental, but one needs to replace it with something to actually connect amplitudes for less complicated and more complicated boundary data. And the main idea to do that is actually just a generalization of what we use already in using these inductive Hilbert space techniques in loop quantum gravity. So the idea is that the discretization just determines the wave function for a small subset of the degrees of freedom, and all other degrees of freedom are put in the simplest states, which is a vacuum state. And the main challenge now is to be consistent, because the observers you evaluate should not depend on the choice of discrete structure which you used to compute it. And so what you have to choose is kind of first an embedding of coarser Hilbert spaces into finer Hilbert spaces. And what you want to have is that these amplitudes consistently pull back under this embedding. And that basically means if you want to evaluate a very coarse observable, you can just take the coarsest amplitudes available. And so from a complete construction of our quantum gravity dynamics would give you basically all the amplitudes for the most complicated boundary Hilbert spaces. And this would define you a theory of quantum gravity in the sense of a theory corresponding to a complete renormalization trajectory. And here scale is given by this complexity parameter. Okay. So in this formulation, we don't have this gluing principle anymore, so we just refer to the boundary. And the question is whether this is a fundamentally holographic formulation. And so far, this has been just, on a very abstract level, but it opens this question, what can we say about boundary dynamics? And a case which we can attack is the topological field theory, which is actually 3D gravity, where we may have a chance to compute the boundary amplitudes in general. And speaking of holography, of course, there's questions coming up, which is the relation to ADS-CFT dualities, which also have been extended to the flat case and on a more conjectural level to the de Sitter case. Okay, so slide 8. Sorry, I actually skipped slides. I was on slide 7. Now I'm on slide 8. Gives you basically further motivation more specific to this talk. So the aim is to provide a concrete model for holography that connects non-perturbative and discrete approaches to continuum approaches. And the strategy is to work with an explicit realization of 3D quantum gravity and to first see what is possible to realize it in a more non-perturbative realization. In the context of 3D gravity, puzzle stated often by Caleb is, what are actually, how do we get a conformal field theory from a topological field theory, where in principle we can capture the degrees of freedom by a discretization and typically by a very coarse discretization. And the further motivation and actually an invitation is basically something which was put up by Laurent some time ago, is really to go on and to look whether we can use these dualities in our non-perturbative approaches. And to that end, we need to develop a strategy. And several of these questions we can ask is, can we do things at the finite boundary that would simplify our life considerably? Can we go away from EDS? And can we work with an auxiliary discretization? Okay, so that finishes the rather long motivation part. I go on and explain basically the continuum theory of the computation we are going to do. And this is now known as thermal flat 3D space, which has been considered in the last years. And so if you go on slide 10, I have a short review on what happened in the 3D gravity correspondence to CFT. So basically, it started very early with Brown and Hinault, which noticed that there is a central extension of the asymptotic charge algebra in the ADS case, leading to a Virasoro algebra. And later, there was basically all this work on ADS-CFT. Relationship between basically the Virasoro algebra and 3D gravity was, among other things, used to compute the entropy of BTZ black holes. So there has been lots of work, but in 2008, there's basically a computation was done, which is to evaluate the one-loop partition function in the continuum theory, and one could show that it exactly reproduces the character of the Virasoro algebra, which one expects from having the CFT, and it's the Virasoro algebra which follows from the charge algebra in the ADF case. In particular, the one-loop partition function is exact, and that's why we later just take linearized batch calculus, because that's how we can actually compute the one-loop partition function. This has been in ADF, mostly. In the last years, in particular, Barnish and company considered the limit to flat space, which from our perspective is interesting because we can more easily quantize the flat space case. Indeed, there's also a central extension for the asymptotic charge algebra, in this case the BMS group at null infinity. And very recently, a computation was done, which basically is a version of the ADS computation, which is to compute the one-loop partition function, and it again reproduces the character of the BMS group. So on slide 11, I basically review this computation. And the first thing is to specify the geometry which has been considered in this case. So that's the background geometry, and it's known as thermal spinning flat space. So what one takes is basically flat space and writes it in cylindrical coordinates, and taking the boundary at some constant radius, we get a solid cylinder. Thermal means that we identify basically the time direction, and we get a torus. Spinning actually means that we don't do a trivial identification, but we put a Dehnfest, and the angle of this Dehnfest is known as angular potential. I probably will quite often call it just the twist angle. And that gives you the thermal spinning flat space. And what we want to do is to study the partition function. That is the path integral of fluctuations around the thermal spinning flat space. And this is expected to reproduce basically this character of the Virasoro algebra. And character just means trace. And this is basically the trace of the Virasoro algebra written in Hamiltonian form. Okay. So on slide 12, we just look at the classical limit, so basically the zeroth order of the partition function. And this is in principle extremely straightforward to evaluate, because the bulk term vanishes, we have flat space, and we remain with the curvature term. And on this fixed boundary geometry, you get basically a constant times the area of this torus at unit radius, and the result is the inverse temperature divided by 4g with a minus sign. So we don't have any alpha dependence. And as a comment, it's actually not the result one wants to have. One actually wants to get one half of this result. And what one wants is determined by, in fact, this character of the Virasoro algebra. And in fact, what one would have to do is, if one really takes the boundary to infinity, is to take a different boundary term. But as we now look really for a finite boundary, and we will stick with the standard boundary term, and I will comment on this alternative boundary term at the end, or I have a slide at the end which I might comment or not. Okay, so that was the classical background. And on slide 13, we go to the one-loop correction computed in the continuum. And the one-loop correction is basically the determinant of the Hessian of the action. So if you take the Lagrangian for GR, expand it to second order, What you will get is is in principle a bunch of differential operators, and they are null modes, so you need actually to gauge fix. And if you add the gauge fixing terms, you basically get differential operators for spin 0, spin 1, and spin 2. And taking basically the effective action, which means to take the logarithm of these determinants, you get the result which is shown in the first line. This is combination of the determinants of these Laplacians. And one can evaluate these determinants of these Laplacians by the heat kernel method. And so basically one takes the trace over this heat kernel. One needs basically the heat kernel for all these different modes, and in flat space it's actually easier than an ADF case, where one actually needed to find first the spin 2 heat kernel. And the heat kernels are known for R3, but we want to have actually the R3 divided by this discrete symmetry group, which comes from identifying the cylinder to a torus. And for this, one uses a method of images. And in this method, what basically happens is one takes a summation over the images of the symmetry of these discrete subgroup. And this summation is actually essential because it gives the sum or the product over K, which is shown below. So actually it's kind of a calculation one has to do and to sum all to sort all these terms, and in the end one gets for the exponential of the effective action, or for this basically the measure term, a product which interestingly starts at K equal to 2, and it's are shown there, it's actually divergent if this twisting parameter alpha is equal to 0, and it only depends on the angular potential. So it's something actually quite non-local because it just depends on the angular potential, which is a kind of global information about your space-time. Okay. So this was the review of the continuum calculation, which actually is really a field theory computation and doesn't make use of the topological nature of the theory. And the question, can we change that and understand better the contributing degrees of freedom and structure of the result? Can we do that at finite boundaries? And in this way also address more directly the puzzle how to get the field theory on the boundary from a topological theory. And this was slide 14.
Bianca, have we raised and answered any physical questions so far in these three-dimensional things that you have explained to us, the work of Barnish and others? I understand that some formal, they're good calculations which show that some partition function is the same as some other partition function. But is the physical question we are answering?
So this will be a first step. I mean, the question you can go on is actually to take it for thermal flat space. You have there's already thermodynamics of the space which you can consider, and it's actually just in the ADS case a conformal transformation to the BTZ black hole. So this, in fact, would tell you, you know, where does the entropy come from and connects to work of Kaleb. And actually, I will later comment on the possible extension and possible also apply it to the BTZ black hole at some point of the work we are doing here now. I mean, this work is really to actually first see how much we do in our approaches in using these kind of dualities and the structure of these computations.
Okay, so if I was in classical theory, then since you are looking at a positive definite case, so Einstein sequences are all elliptic. And so it's not very surprising that, that if you give me the data at the infinity or on any boundary, then everything inside is completely determined, just like for Laplace equation or something. So it's not very surprising. So the statement is somehow we are drawing some lessons about the Lorentzian theory, starting from the Euclidean theory, the Riemannian theory, or is this, again, just probing the mathematical structure of the Riemannian theory in its own right?
I mean, I guess, so you are asking question which actually apply to the continuum calculation. And there what one can do is to derive the BMS group and to derive the stuff, you know, on the Lorentzian level. I mean, the BMS group is discussed in the Lorentzian case. Then using this background, you can actually do for the partition function the Wick rotation. I mean, we could have on this one loop level, you could have also done the same calculation on the Lorentzian level, I guess, just that one doesn't use the standard stuff. I mean, if you kind of be careful with analytical continuation. As I told you in this physical sense, I will come to it later, it's really to answer the question, where do the degrees of freedom sit, which give you this entropy, which you find by, or, you know, how do you really get this conformal field theory?
Okay.
Okay, so this is a short review of Regi calculus, which most of you will know. And in the end, we will use linearized Regi calculus, and the first paper was by Rocek and Williams, which showed that it regains basically linearized continuum GR. And let us go to slide 16, which is this review of Regi calculus in 3D. So what we do is to take general relativity and use an arbitrary triangulation to discretize the action, and the variables are given by length variables associated to edges of this triangulation, which defines as a piecewise linear, piecewise flat geometry. So the genius part of this is to basically come up with a Regi action, and I've stated the 3D Regi action, which is a discretization of the continuum action, including the boundary term. And the nice thing is that the boundary term appears quite nicely in the same structure as actually the bulk term. In particular, the curvature is basically captured by these deficit angles, which are just something like conical defects. And on slide 17, we are shortly to review that actually in the case of 3D, Regi calculus really gives us the continuum Hamilton-Jacobi function. And so there's just an easy step, which is to derive the equation of motion. And the Schlafly there's a Schlafly identity which make sure that we don't need to take the variation of the deficit angles, because all these terms vanish if one indeed includes this boundary term. So what we remain with is that the variation of the action gives us a deficit angles times the variation of the edge length, and that means we easily get the result that 3D gravity is flat. And furthermore, if we put the solution back into the action, which defines as the Hamilton-Jacobi function, we see that the Hamilton-Jacobi function is determined by this boundary term. And this is basically the extrinsic curvature of this piecewise flat boundary embedded in flat space. And so this statement embedded in flat space is completely independent of the bulk triangulation you take. So in fact, this is really the continuum GR Hamilton-Jacobi function for piecewise flat boundary data. And this fact that you are independent of the choice of bulk triangulation and have a local action shows you that your theory is actually topological. On slide 18, we basically have a comment on the measure term. So there's, I think it was the second quantization of Regi calculus, because the Ponzano-Regi model might have been before this. So there's basically the alternative quantization of Regi calculus, which is to take the partition function for the Regi action and integrate with a certain measure of the edge length. And as far as I understand, okay, depending on who you ask, you get different answers for the measure. But at least for the linearized theory, we can come up with a measure which actually completely shows also the property which we have seen for the action, namely being independent of the choice of bulk triangulation. And this we had found in a paper with Sebastian Steinhaus. So the key point is that if you compute the Hessian for the different partner moves which describe changes of bulk triangulation, these factorize in a certain way over tetrahedra and edges, so that we can write the local measure which leads to a bulk triangulation independent result. So what we are going to use is basically that for the bulk triangulation, we can take the coarsest triangulation possible. Another point to also review is basically diffeomorphism symmetry in Ricci calculus. And again, in this paper by Rochek and Williams, they, to my knowledge, first identified these null vectors and the null modes which one has, indicating the gauge symmetry of the linearized theory. And these null modes really correspond to the following fact that given a solution of Ricci calculus, we know it's flat. If you have any bulk vertex sitting in this flat space, we can put this bulk vertex at some other place, and this changes the length attached to this bulk vertex. And in fact, this is a gauge symmetry because it changes the bulk length, but not the boundary length. Okay. So this is a short review of Ricci calculus, and going to slide 21, we are now delving into the solid torus partition function a la Ricci. And the questions to answer, again, in view of trying to basically generalize these results for our non-perturbative approaches is, can we take a boundary at finite radius? And do we need to take the continuum limit, and how do we need to take the continuum limit on the boundary? So on slide 22, I have a description of the setup of the entire calculation. So I motivated that we don't need to take a bulk refinement, so we can take the coarsest triangulation possible of the bulk. But in view of the fact that we want to see a field theory on the boundary, we should allow for some kind of continuum limit to take on the boundary. And so the simplest thing which we could come up with is basically this following triangulation of the cylinder, where you slice the cylinder first in time direction, and then you basically divide it up as you do a cake. And so a piece of a cake is given by this prism. And this prism comes with three different edge lengths, the radius, the length of the space-like edges on the boundary, and the time-like edges. And this prism can be split into three tetrahedra, which gives you the triangulation. So it turns out that the volume of all these three prisms is the same in this background geometry. And furthermore, to get flatness at the time axis, what we need is to set the ratio of this length capital L and the radius to a certain value which depends on the number of prisms in a time slice. And I summarize this in this parameter small a because it will also come up later. So the evaluation of the classical Ricci action is again straightforward, and you don't need to take any continuum limit and can take kind of the simplest triangulation with, I don't know, three tetrahedra and just for the entire space-time. And it nevertheless reproduces a continuum result. And so we go on to the one loop correction on page 23. That is, I go slightly through some details, because one question is how does diffeomorphism symmetry show up here? And so one can compute the Hessian first of a prism, and that has already a simple structure, a simple scaling which allows you to factor out most or all of the dimension-full parameters. And one remains with a matrix which is dimension-free and only depends on this parameter little a, that is on the ratio L divided by R. So this Hessian has two null vectors. One of them is one which one expects from the Schlafly identity, and that is the one related to scaling symmetry. If you scale any Ricci solution by a factor, you still get a Ricci solution. And so you get this null vector. But because of the fact that this matrix M only depends on this parameter A, on the ratio of L and R, but not on T, there's actually a second null vector which follows from the scaling symmetry, and that is the scaling in time direction. So I mention that because this scaling in time direction will always give us automatically diffeomorphic symmetry in time direction, and it gives us this diffeomorphic symmetry without taking any continuum limit. So on slide 24, you can shortly admire the Hessian, but actually we basically compute on slide 25. I shortly explain how to compute the full Hessian, and to get it into a manageable form, one uses a lattice Fourier transform. There's a slight twist to this because we have this unusual periodic identification. So if one uses just standard Fourier transform in time direction, that wouldn't help to really diagnose the action in a nice form. So what one has to change is to shift the time frequency by this alpha-dependent term. And this will indeed help to bring basically the hash in block form so that one can conveniently write it just in a matrix which is just the size is just given by the different types of edges one has.
Can you explain the
labeling
key?
Okay, sorry, I actually forgot. So what one does is to first resort the bulk variables, and one gives the bulk variables coordinates, which are basically the coordinates on the boundary of the cylinder, given by this label S, which is the coordinate in angular direction, and N, which is the coordinate in time direction. So basically now we have fluctuation variables, which carry these labels S and N. And this is basically just us on a regular lattice, so we have a two-dimensional lattice. What we do then is to Fourier transform, and the Fourier transforms the wave vectors I call k and nu, and nu is shifted to this wave vector v.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
Where is beta? You said at some point that you correctly reproduce the continuum result, and so you quickly moved on to the Hessian and the loop corrections. In mm-hmm. the continuum result, everything was depending on the inverse temperature. Can you just show us where it is at the disk level? I got lost at some point.
So the beta is just on the in the background evaluation of the action.
Yes.
And beta would show up basically in the number. I mean, beta is basically the global time extension. So in this case, it would show up in the number of time slices times this capital T parameter.
So it's still a continuous parameter.
Yeah, it's discretized by our choice of whatever T is because it has to come in entire numbers in this discretization T.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so basically the entire information will be encoded in this matrix M tilde, which now depends on these time frequencies, on the frequencies K and nu, or K and V. And on page 26, I just show you the Hessian for the byte terms, because that might be still sufficiently simple. So what one gets is that for the T edges, these don't have an angular dependence. So actually they only contribute to the zero mode in spatial direction. And the other thing what one sees is that one easily gets a Laplacian in spatial direction. And the coupling of time slices, this is given by basically the shift in time direction, which is now just omega v, which is just the Fourier coefficient in time direction. And one seeing this, one is first puzzled, because what one expects to get some result which depends on the angular twist, one needs a Laplacian in time direction. And here we just get the Laplacian in spatial direction. And moreover, the coupling in time direction is multiplied with this parameter A, which in principle goes to zero in the continuum limit or in the infinite radius limit. But we will see that it looks much nicer if you integrate out one type of edges. And actually, if you're good in computation, you can see that already from the type of this matrix, that basically if you have a matrix which is once on the diagonal and minus once on the anti-diagonal, it's 2 by 2, and you integrate out one variable, you get actually zero. Okay, so it's completely wrong to take the limit of vanishing A parameter here, because then we would not get any time coupling. Let me just first review the diffeomorphism symmetry which we get in this case on page 27. And that will actually explain the structure of the continuum result. And so we have these byte vertices, and the byte vertices can be translated in three directions. And the translation in time direction actually just affects the k equal to zero mode. And the translation in spatial direction just affects the k equal to plus one and the k equal to minus mode. So one can derive these geometrically, and it's completely mirrored in this matrix. So that makes it easy to deal with diffeomorphism symmetry. So these modes will basically not contribute. And we just, as we will see, we'll discuss in the end just starting with k equal to two modes. So now let's integrate out the d variable, and a priori for k bigger than zero, because for k equal to zero we would get the Laplacian to be zero, and we couldn't integrate it out. And the result is shown on page 28. So if one basically just considers the byte term, now the t edges completely dropped out because they only live at k equal to zero. And we just have the radial edges and these diagonal edges. We integrate out the diagonal edges. And as I mentioned, what happens is that the terms of zero order in A actually all vanish. It's basically the Laplacians in spatial direction. And so the time coupling which we had gives us actually nicely this lattice Laplacian in time direction. And then we have a small correction in A. And in fact, if we take basically the product over this Laplacian in time direction, we do get 2 minus 2 cos alpha k, which is basically already the result we want, which will be shown on the next slide. So we see first that it vanishes for vanishing twists. And then I mentioned that in the continuum you get basically some infinite divergent result for this. And furthermore, it's independent of the number of time steps. And this has something to do with that we basically treat a free particle at every frequency here. And the free particle is basically these RHs. And the higher order terms, even if you basically sum or take the product over these terms, they still give you just a correction to higher order. So if we basically sort all terms on page 29 for basically the square root, the inverse of the square root of the determinant, we get for the angular twist part exactly the result we wanted to achieve. And we also see that we need to take start the product at k equal to 2. And so we get an interpretation of k in the continuum, which here is just the number of modes you can put in your discretization. And each mode contributes basically one factor. And so on slide 30, I summarize the features of this calculation is that I think this kind of calculation is much simpler than in the continuum because we only gauge fix these k equal to 0 plus and minus 1 modes and there's no further regularization necessary. In particular, we do it at finite boundaries. And it identifies the contributing degrees of freedom, which are the R edges in some sense, and it explains the structure of the result. So what we have seen is that we need to take the continuum limit in angular direction, at least, and actually this just holds for the one loop correction, where we put the boundary fluctuations to zero. And on the other hand, actually at least here, we could have just taken one time slice, so t would be equal to beta if you do that, and we would have still found, actually, at least for this alpha-dependent part, the same result. And the reason is that basically we have a free particle and it gives you a perfect discretization for the free particle at each mode. This opens the question whether we can go on and really look at the boundary fluctuations so that we see kind of the field theory which gives rise to this result more directly. And on page 31, I basically summarize what to expect in the continuum. And a priori, it looks simple because what we expect for the effective action of the boundary fluctuations, that is, after keeping the boundary fluctuations as general and integrating out all bulk edge lengths, which would give you the Hamilton-Jacobi function, and this would be to evaluate this extrinsic curvature term on the boundary. Now it's a functional of the boundary metric, and we expect diffeomorphism symmetry, at least under boundary diffeomorphisms. So the only so the boundary metric has three components, but two should be killed by diffeomorphism symmetry, and it should only depend on the conformal modes. And this conformal mode describes you bumps in this boundary, which is embedded in flat space. And actually, there's this thing that you could consider outside bumps and inside bumps, and this functional should not be completely unique, and it's related also to a point Laurent made in his paper, but actually we won't see this non-uniqueness because this non-uniqueness rather shows up for flat boundaries. Now it looks simple, but it's actually harder to evaluate than it seems. For the EDS case, there are some discussions and they are not extremely direct, so to say, and they make heavily use of the Pfefferheim-Graham expansion in the EDS case, which is not really available in the flat case. Let me point out a paper of Caleb, which basically argues and shows that a Liouville field arises as an auxiliary field, and it describes the position of the boundary, and he puts it as this point that this gives you the entropy due to a breaking of 3D diffeomorphisms at the boundary. And Aldo has also looked at this in the flat case, and actually, before we knew about this paper, used a similar construction. So this suggests that our R variable might be something like this auxiliary field, and maybe it is a Liouville field. So it's a bit hard to show this directly from the the discrete calculation we can do. And the reason I explain on slide 32, and basically we can easily compute what we get in the discrete as an effective action. So this, using the techniques I have shown, is just a 3x3 matrix giving you the fluctuations for the three components of the matrix we have on the boundary. And as I mentioned, the Feuermorphic symmetry in time direction, we always get it even on the discrete level. But the Feuermorphic symmetry in angular direction is more complicated to recover. And here is how we recover it. So we take the boundary continuum limit, which is we take the boundary edges to scale with a small parameter, epsilon. And this gives you a certain expansion of these Fourier coefficients which appear in the Hessian. And if we scale epsilon to be small, this also scales A to be small, because A is determined by the number of prisms we have in a time slice. If you take the continuum limit, this number of prisms is infinity. So what we do now is to take basically the Hessian which we have and expand in epsilon and truncate at lowest zeroth order in epsilon. And then we get a matrix in these actually wave vectors, capital K and capital V, which are just some rescaled versions of small k and small v. However, the resulting matrix, at least to our surprise, still breaks angular diffeomorphisms. So what we actually further have to do is to do the following. The matrix which we get are rational functions in K and B, and basically they are rational because there are some non-local terms which come from integrating out the bulk edges. So if you divide by, for instance, V squared, it means that you divide by the time Laplacian. And these, all the terms are either of homogeneity degree 0 and 2. But K and V are entire numbers, so one can argue that basically the degree 2 terms dominate, at least in some regime. And in fact, it's exactly these terms which, if you just keep them, we regain angular diffeomorphic symmetry, and the resulting matrix has two null modes, so we just have one non-vanishing eigenvalue. Okay. So on slide 33, I basically display this eigenvalue. And this eigenvalue is, you know, a function, is just a polynomial of k and v. And it's divided by v squared, so this would be translated in dividing by the Laplacian in time direction. And above, we have basically just this interesting polynomial, which gives us a dispersion relation of our boundary theory. And this eigenvalue, in fact, indeed corresponds to the normal matrix deformation mode, which we discussed in the continuum. So does that correspond to some version of Liouville theory? So what one can do is to take Liouville theory, it's actually always with a vanishing potential, and discretize it and linearize it, and to compare with the resulting effective action. And on a linear level, it's basically, one can do that. And what one gets if one does the standard Liouville action is basically displayed in the left part of the last line. And we see that we get the same nominator. But in this case, and it's easy to see, what you get is basically in the nominator, you get something like curvature squared, and this is divided by the Laplacian. And so you basically see the curvature squared, divided by the Laplacian. The Laplacian actually has this dependence on the boundary edge length, and this is quite different from what we found so far in Ricci calculus, because we found the scaling symmetry. So somehow we already for this reason we can't reproduce this, this result exactly. But knowing this, we can easily put the action which gives us the result which reproduces our eigenvalue, and this is to drop the spatial derivatives of basically the Laplacian part, and this matches our result. And so instead of this Liouville field, we get basically a kind of asymmetric Liouville field which is coupled just, you know, with a time Laplacian, but it's still coupled with a 2D curvature of the boundary. Okay, basically that finishes this thing and shows that indeed the degree of freedom you get is really by taking the continuum limit, and then you can basically describe the Hartle-Hawking wave function in this case with this boundary theory given by this particular version of the Liouville field.
So this is all valid at finite R.
And we have not taken any R limit.
So R appears in gamma.
Yeah, R could appear. Yeah. So basically what we haven't done, but what we could, is actually try to repeat this in the continuum in the same kind of linearization. At a non-linear level, as I said, if you look at the papers, it's not straightforward to evaluate this boundary term. And basically this kind of CFT, I mean, whatever it is, field theory would basically be kind of dual to the gravity thing in this sense. Okay. So on page 34, I'm going on to make some remarks on basically the extension of possible extension of the theory, because we see it partially as a step to really go on and to look into non-perturbative things. So basically, a question by Laurent was that this is valid at finite R, so indeed we could maybe indeed get something by looking at finite radius. This kind of calculation we have done is quite straightforward to generalize to DS and ADS case. And ADS case is actually simpler because this boundary term people use is much simpler than in the flat case. And one has one more thing to scale. So, and of course, one shouldn't use flat tetrahedra, but the curved ones. It might be even possible to say something on the full non-perturbative version. And this would be basically the Ponzano-Reggie model, which is the quantization of BF theory. And so one needs to consider BF theory with a boundary. Now, Valentin and Matteo have done it quite intensely in the case, and actually published these results in the case of no boundaries, but there are unpublished notes on the case with boundary. And one knows in mathematical terms what one gets, kind of the Weidemeister torsion or the Ray-Singer torsion. But you know, one needs actually to relate it to this particular case. If one takes a positive cosmological constant, this is of course the Tour-Rafiro model. So for the hyperbolic case, we don't really have an explicit model in terms of BF, as far as I know. But there could be a question which stands for, can use analytic continuation of Tour-Rafiro result and think about BTZ, as has been done some time ago by Mark and Karim. And one point here is actually to emphasize this. We saw that this conformal field theory really arising only in the continuum limit. So basically there's basically really this continuum limit one would have to take, and actually it simplified at least some set of results. And this, as far as I know, has not really been done in the non-perturbative case. So I conclude in 35. So in this case, in 3D, the discrete models provide an elegant method to a valid partition function. Actually, the one-loop calculation, at least for me, was the first time that the discrete case was easier than in the continuum. And I've done lots of discrete calculations. It provides an explicit model for holography based on a topological field theory. And one can develop it further to provide a toy model for understanding the continuum limit and background independent theories in this consistent boundary formulation. It confirms interpretation which has been put up by Caleb in particular to understand the entropy of BTZ black holes, where for a long time he's actually interested in considering the Virasoro algebra at the horizon, which recently, you know, attracted more interest. So we find this auxiliary field, which is kind of related to these radial edges, and it's a field theory which gives rise to this entropy. There's this bit puzzling feature that so far this regaining of angular diffeomorphism symmetry is more involved than we would wish for. One could maybe change that by using different building blocks which have one side curved, but then the question is how to relate it to the Fontan-Reggio model. So let me mention on page 36 that there are many further directions to explore. So we have taken the simplest bulk triangulation possible. One can actually introduce a subdivision in radial direction, and then one gets building blocks, basically one gets rings, which are something like related to holographic renormalization. And then these rings are built out of prisms and cuboids. And so this would give us an explicit kind of holographic renormalization map of the field theory at this given radius to a field theory at a bigger radius. And it's also related to ideas which came up with the so-called MERA tensor networks and the relation of these tensor networks to ADS. And putting these cubes in, again, is quite straightforward because we basically have computed these things in the paper with Laurent and Simone. The interesting direction is to think about BTZ black holes, and which is related to basically this thing is Caleb states. That's an open question to apply it to the Zeta case. Another question is, can we apply it to 4D? And in this case, we would certainly need to take the bulk continuum limit. And there's an open question about which measure to take. A more mathematical question is to relate actually these things to really the Virasoro algebra, which would require a Hamiltonian analysis on the boundary, which, you know, relates to lots of work in the discrete and to also work of Laurent on what to do on a boundary. Okay, so basically that finishes my talk. I have on page 37 more comments on the boundary term, but maybe I stop here and take questions.
So questions?
So one question, so maybe it was not very clear to me, at least from the presentation, but how about this measure term that you proposed with Sebastian? Do you get like further confirmation that this is the correct one from the analysis you did, the computing the one-loop corrections, or this is not sensitive enough to the measure term?
So it's good to notice, I skipped this detail. So it's a correct one with respect to boundary triangulation independence, because that's the only one being independent of boundary triangulations. We have given the measure term for the boundary theory. Actually, what you get, however, is in the end, for instance, in the one-loop correction or in the with or without fluctuations, you still get a measure term also in the discrete, and you still get a measure term, and this measure term depends on the discretization of the boundary. So to deal with this thing and to get a result which kind of matches the continuum, we would need to think really about these embedding maps, which would basically kind of make these measure terms consistent with different choices of the boundary triangulation. So that hasn't been covered in the paper by with Sebastian.
I have a question concerning the continuum limit, but in the full model, because now in the Ponzano-Reggie model, there's a discretization of the edge length, which means presumably that at finite R, the continuum limit is not an infinite refinement limit.
Uh-huh.
So is there any indication of how that would work?
Maybe that would be a nice opportunity to check how it would work, in the sense that one expects something like the continuum limit to kind of trivialize after going beyond the scale which is given by the smallest edge length.
Mm-hmm.
But usually this argument is actually applied to the bulk. It's basically...
Yeah.
Indeed an interesting question. So I do think that these unpublished notes, I'm not sure, I mean, they are still quite mathematical, I guess. So in principle, one knows that one gets this Ray-Singer torsion or the Rademeister torsion in this case of quantized BF theory, which should be the Ponzano-Reggie model. So it's an interesting thing to consider also towards the full theory, what happens in the continuum limit there.
But one expects some kind of, you know, that we do not have to take an infinite refinement limit there for finite power.
No, at least, personally, you know, to make sense out of it in the consistent boundary formulation.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be to show that basically this discreteness of the spectra is consistent with taking continuum limit,
mm-hmm.
or that it survives continuum limit. Yeah.
Can I have another question?
In your result,
you basically explain the absence of these kappa equals 0 and 1 modes, that is the fact that the product starts at k equal 2 in terms of gauge symmetry, null modes, right? These are absent because they're null modes they're zero modes that you got rid of. So my question is, was there some hint that this is also the explanation for the absence of these modes in the continuum calculation?
In the continuum calculation, it's actually not extremely transparent because it takes the sum over k, or the product over k, which you see there, comes from the sum over images, and then there's these three different terms. And so, for a long time, you sum over all k's, and then there's a final rewriting, which gives you the k over 2. So one would need to really go to the continuum calculation and see, trace back the cancellation of spin 2 and spin 1 and spin 0 to extract this thing that basically the spin 0 and the spin 1 degrees of freedom are killed by gauge symmetry. I mean, it's not obvious to me from the paper I've seen. And
okay.
Also there, the sum is okay, I mean, you could relate it to a sum over momenta, but originally it's really the sum over images of the discrete symmetry group.
If I go back to, you very nicely explained that in the negative cosmological constant case, this would be sort of way to understand kind of the degrees of freedom that contribute to the entropy. And maybe looking at the finite boundaries and so on, ultimately one might even look at if these degrees of freedom can be associated with the horizon, if the calculation can be sort of continued to the Lorentzian domain. But in the kind of the most of your talk was with the zero cosmological constant case. And I want to return to that as to, is there a physical question that we can ask in this case? One of the things you mentioned was this work of Barnish et al. And having to do the BMS group. So I just want to understand one thing first, that BMS never worked out, the Bonnie Messner sacks never worked out, the asymptotic symmetry group in the three dimensions, because the structure is actually quite significantly different in three versus four dimensions. And this is something that was worked out by with a joint paper that I wrote with Ben Schmidt and Ishi Bijak. And there, even though the asymptotic symmetry group has the same structure, namely still a semi-direct product of super translations with something, that something is now itself in three-dimensional, namely it is the DFS1 group, so it's kind of the Virasoro group. So are they, is that the reason why somehow there is a relation between, when you say character of the BMS group, I mean presumably you are talking about our group, which is the DFS1, because the standard BMS group doesn't have any meaning in three dimensions. So is it related to just DFS1 and again Virasoro? And if so, kind of what is the physics of it and so on? Can you explain?
Okay, so basically the BMS group in 3D. Okay, what I know, I haven't seen your paper, and
1996 paper.
So basically it's work which has been what we refer to is work which has been done by Barnish in the last years, and they basically constructed the representations of the BMS group. I think it was this year and last year. It could be that I'm not sure whether they use an extension of the BMS group, but they get a Virasoro algebra.
Yeah, so they're using our group. They're using our group. Barnish used to be a postdoc a long time ago, so they are using our group. I mean, in fact, around the time that this work was done, he was here.
Okay. So basically they have worked out this representation theory very recently. I mean, I have here stated 2015. And from this, it follows. From this, you can conclude what is the character of this group. Now, physically, what I understand is basically one does all this analysis. There are some other papers which kind of claim there's actually some non-relativistic contraction of this group. But what I find interesting in this case is to have a really direct correspondence between the boundary theory, between this effective action, this and the CFT, and possibly at a finite boundary. So this would be kind of the most direct way to see it using, possibly seeing these things using these techniques. So here you are right, we do things at Euclidean signature, and then this BMS group is completely not obvious.
But I mean, in the 2 plus 1 theory, we know it completely, right? In the Lorentzian domain or in the Euclidean domain from the canonical perspective or from any other perspective. So somehow, I'm still very disjoint. I mean, I don't understand what this character of the BMS group has to do with what we understand in from the canonical perspective. Can we understand what is it that we're calculating, which is sort of physical?
So, okay, that is basically what I stated on page 11. It's basically having the Virasoro algebra, its representation. You take the character of the representation you think is relevant, and that translates into the trace of these exponential of the canonical generators, and that gives you some result, and you want to reproduce this result with a one loop partition function.
So this is something that we would never see in the canonical framework that we always, you know, that people have talked about the 2 plus 1 gravity in the Lorentzian domain, for example, or in the Euclidean domain, if you like, in the canonical picture a long time ago.
That Virasoro is something you would see in the canonical domain, and the one-loop partition function is a covariant thing.
So can you explain? Okay, so somehow you are saying that it was always there, but we never saw the Virasoro in the canonical domain before, because we had the complete observables, you know, it was just the modular space of flat connections.
Yeah, so basically, I'm not, you know, I cannot really compare now with the papers of Barnish and your paper. You know, what is the difference there? But it's basically these things which happened in 2014, 2015, where they state this is the algebra they get, this is the Virasoro algebra, and
can we see the Virasoro algebra in the old canonical picture that we used to have, you know? You're saying that we should have seen it, but we somehow didn't see it because we're not looking at the asymptotically flat case or something?
For instance, the only thing I can say is that this alternative boundary term, which is quite unusual, you know, this paper is from 2014. It could be related to this, but I'm not sure because I don't know your work, that's to say.
Forget about the work in the MS group. Forget about that work. The question was just about the canonical theory that we sort of thought we understood, right? Looking at 2 plus 1 gravity in terms of modular space of flat connections, and you construct things. And now, somehow, there is something new, namely, this, what you're saying is representations of the BMS group. And that we never saw in the canonical picture, or did we?
Comment on that, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure if that's the canonical theory, because the canonical theory in particular builds on the manifolds being globally hyperbolic. I mean, here in particular, the compactification in time direction and the twist that happens when you do that compactification is a very important part of the path that you will write. I mean, that's probably not anything that can show up in the canonical theory. Would you agree?
Yeah. No, I mean, I wouldn't agree, but Laurent has a comment, and I can again say I would have to look at your paper and compare with the papers of Barnish in the last year.
Okay, thank
but
you.
But I guess, I mean, to clarify, the statement which is on page 11, I mean, you know, it comes, there's an analog of that statement, or there should be an analog of that statement in the canonical theory. That is, if you were computing the gravitational Hamiltonian on a time slice that has the topology of a disk, right, which has an asymptotic circle boundary, then a priori the you know, ADM Hamiltonian is supposed to be the Virasoro generator. That's the claim. So, you know, if you were doing the calculation of the ADM Hamiltonian with proper, you know, boundary condition on the circle, then, you know, it should give you H, this Hamiltonian. That's the claim. And if that's true, then 11 follows.
Okay, thank you, Laura. But so the point is that even the ADM Hamiltonian is a little bit tricky in three dimensions because of there's a conical, even at infinity, you don't get flatness, right? You've got this conical deficit angle, and the ADM Hamiltonian is bounded above and all those things, right? I mean, but if it is true that from slide 11, the last line is actually derivable from that well-understood Hamiltonian. This was a completely different paper that Madhavan and I had written. And people like Glenn Barnish and Mark Hano and so on use it in three dimensions. So if it is true that we can use those generators of the Hamiltonians to really, then from the canonical theory, give meaning to this, that would be very nice. But I think as we just heard that maybe this is not possible because one is doing certain operations in the path integral approach, which may not be translatable in the canonical picture. Do you have any comments on that, Laura?
I don't know. I mean, I would think that you should be able in that particular 3D case, but I'm not sure what's the status of the... I think it's worth trying somehow, you know, getting this boundary Hamiltonian from the canonical picture on a disk. Okay. I don't see any impossibility there in doing it.
Thank you.
Question?
Go ahead.
A very basic question. Where in all of this does the temperature show up in the final results for the partition function? Because this is a, because you've made the identification in imaginary time, these are all thermal partition functions you're evaluating.
It shows up in the zeroth order result?
Just in the zeroth order and not in the one loop result.
In the one loop result for vanishing fluctuations, boundary fluctuations, it does not show up because you have only the dependence on the twist angle.
So the temperature just shows up in the area of the boundary term?
Yeah.
Can one see any relations like the first law between the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, the temperature and the entropy, the surface entropy?
Yeah, you can see the first law if you put the 1/2 factor, which is related to this alternative boundary term, which is derived in the paper by 2014, and I comment on my last slide of the talk. You see what you have to do in ratchet calculus to accommodate this boundary term at a finite boundary.
Okay, thank you.
So indeed, this is one motivation to take this alternative variational principle at infinite boundary to get the first law.
Okay, and just to clarify what I understood Abai was asking, this is a completely independent approach to the quantization of 2 plus 1 gravity than the connection representation approach related to Chern-Simon theory.
In Chern-Simon, it's kind of, as you told me at some point, straightforward to get the conformal theory, but it happens through the gauge breaking of the gauge group.
Right.
And we get
the Wessumino-Witten. Boundary theory in that case, the Wessumino-Witten model of the Lorentz group.
But in the metric variables, it's in fact, and as Caleb comments in his paper, it's not clear how to relate it to the metric variables.
So your results don't provide further illumination about the relation between these two approaches.
Yeah, it might be, but I haven't thought in this direction, the Chern-Simon thing.
Okay.
I mean, you find, basically, it could help to identify what kind of field theory you get at the boundary, also in the metric variables, and it's more straightforward if you use Chern-Simon. But then the mechanisms are very different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's also very, to get Wessumino-Witten on the boundary, you put very different boundary conditions.
Yeah.
So the dynamics is the same, but the sets of boundary condition is very different. You need to put What?
The two boundary theories are just different. For example, in the gauge case, one is including a lot of configurations with degenerate metrics. And in the Reggie calculus approach, there's no weight on configurations with degenerate metrics. So they're just
different. In the Chern-Simon case, you don't fix the metric. You fix some kind of chiral component of the current. And that leads to a very different boundary theory.
Okay. Thank you.
But they are somehow related in a non-local, non-obvious manner.
Okay, if there are no more questions, I'll thank Bianca again.